Northwest flight attendants may take off.
The Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Mark Austin Thomas. Northwest Airlines has been in a tug of war with its flight attendants for some time. Now it wants to force them to accept a cost-cutting contract. This comes after attendants rejected a deal with the airlines. This is the second time the employees have said no to Northwest. Annie Baxter says this could lead to a strike.
55% of the flight attendants who voted rejected the agreement with Northwest. But within a few hours of that news breaking, the bankrupt airline imposed its desired wages and work rules anyway. The rejected contract sought $195 million in concessions. Flight attendants say the deal would have gouged their overall take-home pay by as much as 40%. The union says it will now consider implementing a so-called chaos strike, which involves random work stoppages. But aviation analyst Barbara Beyer says a strike could backfire.
Northwest has basically been fairly ruthless, traditionally, for years and years and years, about being hard-nosed about replacing strikers.
Beyer says there are lots of experienced flight attendants who've been furloughed at other airlines who'd rush to fill jobs at Northwest. In St. Paul, Minnesota, I'm Annie Baxter from Marketplace.
What's big and what's small? I ask that question because I'm not sure anymore. Last week, we told you how the Bush administration decided that Microsoft was a small business and eligible for certain business contracts. Now we're finding out the USA Today, the New York Times, the Associated Press all received government contracts reserved for small businesses. These media outlets say, wait a minute, we don't think of ourselves as small. They say it was the government that gave them this designation. An investigation by House Democrats discovered about $12 billion in contracts to big companies were cited as going to small businesses. The Senate is likely to approve an offshore oil drilling bill this week, but it raises a couple of questions. One, how will the differences between the Senate bill and the House version be resolved? Second, does the Senate measure take the country towards energy independence? Here's Marketplace's Scott Tong.
The Senate bill would give drillers access to 8 million acres in the Gulf of Mexico. Natural gas there could yield a fraction of 1 year's supply for America. That's compared to 4 years of supply in the House bill, which allows much more exploration. Even if the two chambers resolve their differences and the drillers drill, is anything really down there? Here's Mike Rogers of PFC Energy.
If you went out and looked at the last, say, 10 to 20 years, frontier plays are successful in less than 20% of the cases. So in other words, for every five new frontier exploration play concepts we come up with, we're pretty lucky if one of those actually works.
The promise in the Gulf is largely natural gas, but even if there's oil too, no one's talking energy independence. Each day, America consumes 20 million barrels. It produces 5 million. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Well, the Dow fell yesterday, and other market indicators were also down at the close of business. The Dow slipped 34 points to 11,185. The Nasdaq was down 2 points at 2091. The S&P was basically flat, down a point at 1276. This is Marketplace. It's going to be a scorcher on the East Coast again today. In New York, a lot of big buildings have agreed to cut their power usage in exchange for getting some cash back. Ashley Milne-Tite has that story.
Macy's, Starwood Hotels, New York University Medical Center, they're some of the institutions that have received $110,000 for promising to give back to the New York grid if they're asked to.
The buildings are being paid to make a commitment. So they say that I will be on call for the months that I participate in this program.
That's Rena Russell of Consumer Powerline, which has helped these businesses identify where they can scale back. Gary Brown works with New York's grid operator. He says middlemen like Russell's company are bringing many more businesses on board.
They try to put together a portfolio of customers that can reduce megawatts instead of kilowatts.
Not to mention eliminate the need for another power plant. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
You're listening to American Public Media.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Medtronic, partnering with physicians, patients, and diabetes educators to provide better glucose control for long-term diabetes management. Information available at Medtronic.com. And by Reuters, reporting from around the world, every day, every hour, every second. Reuters helps you stay in the know now.
This is Marketplace. I'm Mark Austin Thomas. a black box for stashing trillions of dollars. That was the description a Senate panel used to describe offshore tax havens for the wealthy. An investigative subcommittee of the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee concluded a year-long investigation. It said these offshore accounts allow wealthy Americans to avoid paying between $40 and $70 billion a year in taxes with the help of an armada of professional advisors. One solution, change the tax, securities, and money laundering laws. They should presume that U.S. citizens would be taxed on money in a trust or corporation in a country known by the Treasury Department to be a tax haven. There were a lot of finger-pointing by all the different nations involved when the Doha Global Trade Talks collapsed last week. Now, President Bush is promising to try and revive negotiations. He believes the U.S. economy will get a boost from opening foreign markets. But getting to that goal means finding some way to overcome 5 years of stalemates, especially over agricultural subsidies. The president and the rest of the world had better act fast, according to writer and commentator Zanny Minton-Beddoes.
History shows that deadlines in trade negotiations are broken more frequently than plates at Greek weddings. The last global trade round, called the Uruguay Round, suffered a similar collapse in 1990. Commentators then fretted about the future of the global trading system. But only 3 years later, the biggest and most far-reaching global trade deal to date was signed. Perhaps the recent Doha collapse, too, may turn out to be a temporary hiccup. Perhaps. But the world's taking a big gamble, and doing so with an extraordinary and outrageous complacency. In fact, the Doha round may be rather more difficult to revive than its predecessors. We've got more players involved now. No longer can America and the European Union cook up a deal and dictate it to others. America's political calendar adds complications. George Bush's Trade Promotion Authority, whereby Congress promises not to pick apart the details of a trade agreement, runs out next June. Without it, America can't negotiate trade deals. Democrats tend to be more skeptical of trade, and they're likely to gain seats in November's midterms. So the president's chances of winning an extension to his Trade Promotion Authority are slim. All of which suggests that a Doha deal, if there is a deal at all, may be several years down the line. That alone is an outrage. Every delay to a Doha deal means that the gains from freer trade are put off, a shameful outcome, especially for the poorest countries. The end result may be that countries will move even faster towards bilateral and regional trade deals. Those deals may divert more trade than they create. And they'll also require fiendishly complicated rules. That adds costs onto businesses making products from components in many countries. That may be a particular problem in Asia, the world's fastest growing region. By one estimate, Asia will have a noodle bowl of around 70 free trade agreements by the end of this year. Last week's collapse may not have hocked the headlines, but it could mark a turning point we will all come to regret.
Zanny Minton-Beddoes is the U.S. economics editor for The Economist magazine. And in Los Angeles, I'm Mark Austin Thomas. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day.
American Public Media.
They're called supernotes, fake.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.